Let's turn back to 2 Timothy chapter 4 as we are nearing the end of our study here of believers in the last day, in the last days. And we come to verses 9 through 15 of chapter 4. Lord willing, we will finish this up next week. And I have been praying about what to bring next, and a thought has come to my mind. Kind of in preparation for Revelation when Acts gets done, to lay the groundwork. Back when I was in college, a class that was available in Bible connected these two together as a class, and that was Daniel and Revelation. And they go hand in hand. They are helpful, and I think it would be helpful for us to look at Daniel and see what's there, because it does lay out the end times. What's coming, what has come in some respects. Some of it's already past, some of it's still future, and I think it would help, I trust, lay the groundwork for us in preparation for Revelation when it comes. So I'm looking at starting in on that then in just a couple weeks to go into the book of Daniel and take a look at it, and study it on Wednesday night. So pass word along, that might draw a few more that will be interested in Daniel to come on in on a Wednesday night. It won't hurt them, it'll help them, and to take time to be together. But we're back here in 2 Timothy chapter 4. We'll read verses 9 through 15, and then we'll come back through and make our way through them. Says, do thy diligence to come shortly unto me, for Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world, and is departed into Thessalonica, Crescens to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Take Mark and bring him with thee, for he is profitable to me for the ministry. And Tychicus have I sent to Ephesus. The cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when thou comest, bring with thee, and the books, but especially the parchments. Alexander the coppersmith did me much evil. The Lord reward him according to his works. Of whom be thou ware also, for he hath greatly withstood our words. And so we'll kind of wrapping it up, as it were, this epistle that Paul has been writing to Timothy. And we look at some personal requests here in verses 9 through 13, as he notes some things. He's calling on the realization that he once would like Timothy to come. But as we consider these things, and as we've looked through this epistle, ministry is people. I mean, if you're not here, I don't have a ministry. You know, for some of us, we did speak to a empty building during parts of COVID, at least in the craziness that was the state of Washington. I did for 3 months, and recording messages on my iPhone and then posting them on our YouTube channel that we had created, so that something could at least be out there for our people while we were separated from each other for a time. But that was one of the hardest things to do, is to speak to people that weren't there. You know, looking at an empty auditorium, and there was nobody that I could look at and see the reactions, get what's going on, and it made for a difficult time. But ministry is people. And I have at times humorously said, the ministry would be great, and others have said, or what is the greatest thing in the ministry? The people. What is the worst thing in the ministry? The people. Others have said, the ministry would be great if it weren't for the people. I wouldn't go that far. I would say, yeah, the greatest things about the ministry are the people, and some of the hardest things about the ministry are the people. Because that's what we're dealing with, and realizing that that's where issues come from, is from people typically, and we've got to work through them. And we see Paul attempting to do that, as he's touched on it. I mean, he's given us names of people to be watchful, as he warns Timothy. He's doing some more of that. And he's also mentioning people that God is using in some respects and some that have God is not, but he notes that. You know, God is making sure that we understand when it comes to the ministry, we're going to have our ups and downs. We're going to have people that follow, and we're going to have people that turn away. God doesn't gloss over that. He doesn't give us all the good stuff and then not tell us about the problems that can arise. He lets us know. And I am, you know, as a pastor, I am thankful for that, that he gives us these things. I would hate to have gone through college hearing only of the grandiose good things of ministry. I'm thankful that many of my Bible professors, my Bible teachers, were also pastors who could relate, besides the pastoral classes that, you know, I took, but they could relate and show us, you know, life is not a bed of roses when you leave this place, guys. You know, your churches are going to have good people, yes, and there are going to be some times when these good peoples will be challenging people. And you're going to have to learn to work through this and deal with these things and keep on keeping on. Because ministry is people, and people aren't perfect. You're not perfect. And so Paul is, again, making that clear to Timothy as we work through here. But he notes here he desires for him to come to see him in Rome. And so there is that desire for him to come to visit Rome. But he brings up, and part of the reason for, I think, calling for Timothy, because he uses the word for, kind of the reason why I want you to do diligence and come to me is because Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world, and is departed unto Thessalonica. And so we have a desertion of a co-worker. Now, we don't see much about Demas. We find him in Colossians chapter 4, verse 14, and Philemon, verses what, 23 and 24, if I'm looking at my notes right. We're closer to Philemon, so we'll pop over there. Yeah, he's mentioned in verse 24 of Philemon. Again, I believe it's Colossians 4:14. And so that's about it. Three places where we find Demas, but two of them being earlier in time, Colossians being a prison epistle, Philemon being a prison epistle, written, as we would know it, at the end of the book of Acts, his first Roman imprisonment. And Demas is one of those that's living for the Lord, serving him, a servant that God is using. But as we come to the end of Paul's life, and we come about 6, 7, 8, 9 years after the end of the book of Acts, we find that Demas has forsaken him. He's abandoned him. That word forsaken in the Greek speaks of abandoning, desertion, to leave in straits or to leave helpless, totally abandoned, utterly forsaken. He just up and left. And would have nothing to do with Paul. And Paul notes here that there was a cause for this, having loved this present world. And he uses that strong word agape, agapao, for this love. And it's interesting that he would use such a strong term, but I think it's because of what happened. He's stopped loving what he should have loved and is loving other things that he should not. And the present world, the word here in the Greek is what we would know as eons, so to speak, the age particularly. We have ion and cosmos are the two Greek words, and so I'll give a quote here that helps kind of understand these two distinctions. Our Bibles will often translate them both world. Sometimes they may put age for ion, but to try to make that distinction. But he notes here, it says, it is only in a part of their meanings that these two words, ion and cosmos, are in any real sense synonymous. And it is that part which is here considered. The King James often translates ion by world, thus obscuring the distinction between it and cosmos. Ion is usually better expressed by age. It is the world at a given time, a particular period in the world's history. Cosmos has very frequently an unfavorable meaning, denoting the inhabitants of the world, mankind in general, as opposed to God. A similar meaning is often attached to ion. It means the spirit of the age, often in an unfavorable sense. And so we have that synonymous, but not quite, because they do depict certain things that are completely different. And so Demas has loved this present age, that present world that he was living in. Something drew him away from following fully after Christ. Did he lose his salvation? No. We might wonder whether he was truly saved. That would be a valid question to ask him, should we ever have had the opportunity to. Because God notes to us that, you know, you live for me, you know, there's bliss, but you turn away from me and there's chastisement. And we don't know the rest of Demas' life here, but, you know, it's a tragic result, a tragic spot here to say that he's forsaken me. He's abandoned me at a time of need. I'm in prison. And the time of my life is drawing to a close. And here this beloved friend, this fellow minister, has turned his back on me. And not just on me, but on the ministry itself, because he's loved this present world, the age in which he was living, and has gone back, many believe, back to where he came from, Thessalonica. Again, that's just kind of speculation because it's just noted that he's departed unto Thessalonica. It could be that's where he came from. We don't know because there is no recorded biblical text to know where he came from, and there's no extra-biblical that notes anything about him. But Demas's heart was turned from God to the things that this world offers. And it is sad to see that happen in folks. And yet it does. The glamour of the world. Many of us may remember Disney's Pinocchio, and you see the draw of the world in Pinocchio as he goes, and he's drawn into that and realizes the errors of his ways. And it's interesting how we see those things depicted and in olden days, I would say, because there's not much out there warning us about the world today apart from the church. And even then, some churches aren't warning about the world and what it has to offer is not good for us as believers. But he notes that, and I think Paul rightly is noting that and giving Timothy that warning. You know, Demas has left us. Let's be mindful of that. Now, I would not say that he would say, you know, don't interact with him, but realize he's gone a different path. Be mindful of that. And so we see that happening. But then he also notes some others for other reasons have moved on. He notes that Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus unto Dalmatia, and that's a new area. Dalmatia is farther up on the, Greece is a peninsula, and so Dalmatia would be on the Adriatic seaside of Greece, on what would be the western side of that peninsula, up where Albania is today, and the other Balkan countries that are there. And we'll touch a little bit on that when we get into our third missionary journey on Sunday nights. It's a region of Illyricum, which is noted in Romans chapter 15, as Paul is concluding that, and he notes he had been to Illyricum. And that's caused people to wonder, where and when, Paul, when did you go to Illyricum? because Luke doesn't record that name, or even Dalmatia, in the book of Acts. But as you look at the book of Acts and read through passages, you find it recorded for us in Acts chapter 20, verses 1 and 2, and we'll not go there. I want to touch that when we get into chapter 20 on Sunday nights. But there's an unknown amount of time where we don't know what happens with Paul. And I would suggest that that's when Paul goes north into Dalmatia, Illyricum, and ministers there, but Luke doesn't record us for it because he didn't go. And based on the things that happened, Paul may not have really had opportunity to tell him about that ministry in order for him to record it in the book of Acts. Paul's, going to note it in to the Romans in chapter 15, verse 19, but not to Luke. And our maps that we've been using will highlight that. That's one of the reasons why that series of maps that I have put up for Sunday nights, that's why I use it, because it's one of the few Bible maps that has Paul on his third missionary journey going up there. If you look in the back of your Bibles and you have the journeys of Paul, the missionary journeys, most likely they don't show you going up kind of the west side of Greece and going farther up and then coming back down. They just don't mark it. And yet, you know, again, Paul notes it to the Romans that he's been there. So he has to have gone sometime. So as you look through and read through the missionary journeys, you find that it's not possible in the first one. They go to Cyprus, they go to Galatia, they go back to Antioch. We've just concluded the second missionary journey, and there's no break, there's no pause, there's no time period where we don't have him someplace. And so it doesn't seem like it's on the second missionary journey, because we have him in places. But when we come to the third missionary journey, there's some spots that open up the door for some movement that's not detailed. And so, again, they have figured that it's probably on the third missionary journey. I have that same thoughts here. But Titus, another one of Paul's younger men that we have an epistle to, has gone up into Dalmatia to, again, preach the gospel. And so he then notes to us that in verse 11, only Luke is with him. Luke, the beloved physician, a man that we saw being picked up in Troas on the second missionary journey before they cross over to go into Europe, as we know it, on the second missionary journey, going over to Philippi and the like. So we know some of him. Luke is still with him, a constant companion of Paul's, a minister that God has been using. And, of course, we know him as the author of the book of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, and the book of Acts. And then also note, we kind of jump forward in time, we've seen Mark before, and we know the problems, as we noted that in the book of Acts. He says, take Mark and bring him with thee, for he is profitable to me for the ministry. And again, we noted that back as we looked in chapter 15 of Acts, and the division, the butting of the heads between Barnabas and Paul over this man Mark, or John Mark, as we would know him, because he left them on the first missionary journey. And on the second one, Barnabas wanted to take him again. Paul said, no, I don't want him to go. Barnabas says, yes, I want him to go. No, I don't want him to go. And so they split their forces. And we see that Barnabas is able to help John Mark through the troubles and trials and maturation that he needs as a believer, so that he becomes profitable in the ministry. And Paul will acknowledge that, as we see here. You know, take and bring Mark here. He's profitable for us in the ministry. And what a joy to see that as we deal with people. Again, as I noted back then, you know, who was right and who was wrong? Yes. Barnabas was right and Paul was right. Barnabas was wrong and Paul was wrong. And because of that, they parted company. I think on good terms, though strongly opinionated in what they were doing, and we talked about that. We'll not go down that road again. But we see the bad. Demas has forsaken me. Well, John Mark forsook them right in the midst of a missionary trip. But God worked in John Mark's heart and has brought him back. And Paul is noting he's profitable now. And he's been probably profitable for quite some time, but there's an opportunity for those two to get back together again here at the close of Paul's life. And he's note that he's profitable. He's useful. God's using him in the ministry. And I know Paul is rejoicing in that and thankful for it. We have Tychicus. He notes in verse 12, Tychicus, he has sent to Ephesus. Tychicus was from Asia, the western Asia Minor Roman province, where Ephesus and Colossae and the seven churches of the book of Revelation are. Tychicus was from that area. He was with Paul during his first imprisonment. We see him noted in Ephesus, in Ephesians chapter 6, Colossians chapter 4. And now he is sending him back there. Obviously, Tychicus has been with Paul for some cause. And now he is able to send him back, in essence, go back home to your area where you're from and go back and minister there. So Paul is seeing people leave him for bad reasons, but he's also dispersing others to head out. There's work to be done. And to me, it would make sense. I mean, Paul's stuck in prison. And as he's already noted, the time of my departure is at hand. I'm not going to be around here very much longer, guys. So I think it is wise and prudent. No reason for you to stay here. You know I'm going to die. Get out there and go to work. Get back in the ministry. I'm not going to be able to go back, but you are. And so we see these going out, hitting these areas, and continuing the work that God had started, yes, with Paul, Barnabas, on that first missionary journey. We see that need going forward. Paul notes a need for personal items. He notes in verse 13, he says, "The cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when thou comest, bring with thee." So he's left an outer garment, not the same word that we were looking at in Sunday school in Matthew. Different Greek word than what we saw there with the coat and the cloak and all of that. It's a different word, talking about an outer garment, though, he had left with Carpus in Troas, and now he wants it to be brought to him. It could be that winter is setting in Rome, and he needs some heavier clothing. This is the kind of outer garment that it's referring to, as a heavier outer garment, and bringing it with him. Bring the books. That Greek word speaks of a small book or a scroll, a written document. Could be a sheet of paper or part of a scroll. So nothing in particular as far as naming what this is. We don't know, other than books. We don't know what books. But then he brings in the word, but especially the parchments. And this Greek word, we get our word membrane from, membrana, but it speaks of the animal skin that is parchment that originated in Pergamos in Asia Minor, one of the seven churches. Parchment was, in essence, created there. Papyrus, using plant leaves out of Egypt to make paper, is where we get our word paper from. It's from papyrus. They would flatten those out and, you know, put them top of each other, squish them and flatten them out and write. That was very fragile. Didn't do good in climate for a long term. But animal skin scraped thin, worked better. And they crafted that in Pergamos and called it, we would call it parchment today. And that's primarily what we have when we look at any of the 5,500 pieces of Greek text that we have of our New Testament Bibles, by and large, they're written on parchment. They're written on animal skins, the Isaiah scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls that were found back in 1947. They're on parchment. That's why they're still around. You don't find papyrus that's a couple thousand years old because it's made out of, you know, organic material that can quickly dissolve and fall apart. So the parchment, many believe this to be scriptures because, you know, it's especially, the books are good, but especially bring the parchments like any preacher. My books are great, but give me the Bible. That I need. That's a must-have. The books, they come and go. They're helpful. But if, you know, those proverbial what-if questions, what book would you like to have with you if you were on a deserted island? I want my Bible. You can take all the other books you want, but I want this book. If I could have some others, that would be great, but first and foremost, this book. Why? Because it's God's Word. It's food for the soul. And I think Paul is noting that by making this distinction here, that scriptures, by this time, many of the books of the Bible have been written. Paul's done his prison epistles. Paul's done the Corinthian epistles. Paul's done the book of Romans. He's finishing up here with 2 Timothy and Titus. So of the 12 books that Paul is writing, 10 of them have already been done. He's working on the last two, 2 Timothy and Titus. So he's got all of Paul's writings, with the exception of the Gospel of John. Matthew, Mark, and Luke have been written. The book of Acts has been written. Probably the book of Hebrews has been written. Jude has been written. James has been written. 1 and 2 Peter are about the same time as Paul is writing here. So we've got a lot of the New Testament in book form, if you will, available, being written out, copied, that Paul would have his hands on, that he wants to read, besides the fact that he still has the Old Testament as well. And so he brings those, you know, bring those with you. And then he gives us, lastly, in verses 14 and 15, some personal warning. There's still some opposition. It says, Alexander the coppersmith did me much evil. The Lord reward him according to his works. Most believe that this is not the same Alexander that Paul mentioned in 1 Timothy, where he warns about an Alexander, because he notes him as Alexander the coppersmith. He doesn't put that nomenclature, on the Alexander in 1 Timothy. It's just Alexander. And so I dare say he's doing that to make that distinction. There's that Alexander that I talked about in the first epistle, but this is Alexander the coppersmith. He did me much evil, of whom be thou ware also, for he hath greatly withstood our words. And so Paul uses some strong words here to bring this up of what Alexander was doing in withstanding him, standing against him, and being verbal and demonstrating things against Paul. We don't know the details, but he is warning Timothy about him and the fact that he has withstood the words of Paul to bring about correction. And again, Paul has noted when you read the book of Philippians, He notes there that in that first imprisonment, there were some that were being emboldened to stand up and proclaim the message of truth because Paul was now sidelined. He was in prison. He couldn't be out there. And so they took courage. We need to fill that gap. But there were others who were being emboldened, but they were trying to add insult to injury to Paul for whatever reason. Not liking that he was in prison or thinking that Paul was in prison because of his own faults, that he shouldn't have been there. And so they're emboldened to preach, but with that understanding that we're hurting Paul because he's doing things wrong. But Paul notes, whether in pretense or not, the gospel is going forward and he rejoices. But here he notes, this man has been withstanding me, and so God reward him according to his works. He turns him over, let God take care of this. God's going to take care of him. I've tried, and he's withstood me greatly. To set oneself against is one thing, to resist, to oppose, but he brings in that adjective and saying, greatly he's withstood me. This man is dead set against getting things right between him and Paul. And that should act, I believe, as a warning to us as well. Be mindful of those who are unwilling to get things right with others. Doesn't mean that we are going to agree on every point. But we should not, as ministers of the gospel, as brothers and sisters in Christ, be to that point where we are withstanding the words of others who are preaching and proclaiming the truth. So we need to be careful along those lines with those things that we may disagree with. And ultimately, if we can't reconcile, yes, turn it over to God. God, you do the work. You can work in hearts far better than I can. And work through those things. So Paul, in bringing this home for us, you know, gives us some positives, gives us some warnings, reminds us that people aren't static. People can be drawn away. People need to go out into the ministry, serve the Lord, and do so faithfully. And so we need to be mindful of that, and where we can and properly should warn folks. Be watchful for this. Be mindful of these things. Because there are people out there that, you know, have the nomenclature of being a Christian that aren't necessarily a Christian. Or they're behaving in ways that aren't conducive for following the Scriptures. And so we need to be mindful of that and watchful of it. And weary, if we can be of help to encourage them to come back to the right way, do so. But if they're unwilling after those admonitions, then, okay, Lord, you take care of it. I've done what I could. You've opened those doors. I've done what I could. They're not. So, Lord, you handle it. I'm going to go on and serve the Lord as we should. And not be thinking, well, if they've gone the wrong way, what good does it do for me? Our whole life needs to be done the right way because we have God's promises waiting for us that he's shown us over and over again through the Scriptures. It's worth living for the Lord regardless of what other people are doing. If we rely on other people for how we want to live, we're going to be pulled back and forth like a yo-yo because we can find people living for the Lord under adverse circumstances. We can find people walking away from the Lord who had good circumstances in which they were in, but they've walked away from them. So the course of humanity and Christian living, we can find everybody in every situation And so if we're using them as our standard, it's, well, I want to go this way. No, I'm not satisfied. I want to go this way because that one's going that way. Let's stick to the Word of God. Follow Him. Follow His teaching, His instruction. And we'll be on a steady course for Him. And we can be of help, I trust, at times to help others as they see our lives as we live for Him, as Paul is doing to Timothy and again to Titus as he writes these letters, encouraging them, keep on keeping on. Live for God. That's the best thing we can do. We'll finish this up with the last section here, verses 16 through 22, Lord willing, next week. And we'll conclude the study of 2 Timothy, believers in the last day, keep living for the Lord. I realize we could have probably said that in the first lesson, but we kind of miss all the other stuff if we just, you know, said that and said that's the whole synopsis of the book. Keep living for the Lord regardless of what's going on. True, but there's so much here that he can help us to understand how to live for the Lord in these days.